Hello, fellow rebel capitalists. Hope you're well. So I wanted to talk about the podcast that everybody is talking about on social media, on FinTwit. And this is a very recent interview with Zoltan Posar, who has predicted the move into Bretton Woods 3.0, or Bretton Woods 3 is what he's calling it. So, in fact, he's not just predicting, he's saying that we have already moved in to this new system of, or this new global monetary system called Bretton Woods 3. So, first and foremost, I want to highlight where you can listen to this. And I actually found this as a result of Lynn Alden, my good friend and business partner, tweeting this out, I think just yesterday. And so this is on a YouTube channel called Financial Repression Authority. And here, this is, I guess, the host. And there is Zoltan. And it's an hour and 20 minutes, roughly. And it is definitely, definitely worth your time. If either this evening or maybe tomorrow, it's what's funny is most of the comments are for Lynn. It says, Lynn brought me here. it's awesome. But yeah, definitely check this out. So here again is where Zoltan is saying that he believes we've moved into this new global monetary system that he's calling Bretton Woods 3. So I've listened to this twice, and I wrote down some notes, just kind of a summary of what I thought the main talking points were. So I wanted to review that with you guys and kind of explain it to you. So when you do watch this, you can have a better idea of what he's saying, because he really uses kind of this esoteric language where if you don't know the lingo, it's hard to follow what he's saying. But if you do know the lingo, it's not difficult at all. And so I was going to kind of go over that with you. Or if you don't have the time to go through this, I'll kind of give you the Reader's Digest version. And then I wanted to go over a question that I got in the forum at Rebel Capitalist Pro. I do live stream Q&As there once a week. And my partners do live streams there. They're the pros, such as people like Lynn Alden and Chris McIntosh and Brent Johnson and Jason Hartman and Tony Greer and Patrick Serezna and I think that's it. I'm missing a couple, but so you'll definitely have to check out Rebel Capitalist Pro. But we're going to get into the forum there in just a moment. But first, let me back here, and I want to go over just, looks like I've got 8 talking points, just to quickly try to summarize what his main ideas were in this podcast and how he's coming to this conclusion that we've already moved into a new global monetary system, Bretton Woods 3. So it starts off by saying that the previous monetary system was really based around what he's calling G7 money or G7 insider money. So when he's referring to that, it's just a fancy way of saying dollars or euros, really liabilities that the West has control over. So banking liabilities, the West has control over. Now that would also be liabilities of not just the central bank, but liabilities of the commercial banks in the euro dollar system or the euro system or the euro yen system. And it would also be liabilities of governments such as treasuries. Because really all treasuries are is just kind of a long-dated dollar. So where your dollar that you have in your bank account is a liability of a commercial bank, the Russian central bank may have dollars that were a liability or are a liability of a commercial bank. They may also have dollars that were a liability or are a liability of the Fed, another central bank. And they also may have treasuries that are a liability of the government. So the government can choose to, hey, I'm not going to pay you back because you're Russia and you're bad. Or the West can issue these sanctions and put all this pressure on the banking system in the Eurodollar market to say, hey, you've got to freeze their FX reserves, which is basically their dollars that are your liability. and on their, you know, asset side on their balance sheet, liability on the commercial bank's balance sheet. And then obviously the Fed is going to do the bidding of the government. So if there's sanctions and the Russian central bank has any dollars on the Fed's balance sheet, then they're going to freeze those as well. So this is what he's basically what he's calling insider G7 money. So he says moving forward, he thinks that we're going to go into a system where they're instead of invoicing for dollars, whether it's China selling us goods or whether it's Russia or Saudi Arabia who is selling commodities, more specifically oil, instead of invoicing in dollars, they're going to invoice in a different currency that's maybe something that it's a currency, it's a liability of a country that they're more friendly with. So as an example, we saw Saudi Arabia say that they're going to start selling oil to China in yuan. So why are they doing that? Okay, because they're receiving yuan. They're stockpiling yuan, if you will. They have a surplus of yuan, and they would prefer to have the counterparty risk with the Chinese than the counterparty risk with the United States or the West. It's basically what they're doing. And he goes on to say that they could prefer to hold gold as well. It'd be maybe an and or that you'd want that Saudi Arabia as an example. Going back to what we were saying earlier, they would choose to hold the yuan with those reserves, or they could take some of the yuan and they would buy gold. So basically the reserve asset that they're holding for the sale of that oil would be yuan, which is something that they feel as though they can utilize in the future and that will maintain its purchasing power for goods coming from China, or the gold will most likely maintain its purchasing power for whatever they want to buy from Russia, India, Brazil, China, these countries that are more friendly to the countries that, in my opinion, will have all the wealth they do have the wealth. It's just underground from the standpoint of, you know, what is wealth? Is it just dollars? No. So the wealth is really the goods and services and the what it takes to make those goods and services, which is really energy and food. So you've got to look around and say, okay, who has all the energy and the food, or who has access to that? Who has control over that, especially at a very low cost? And that would not be the United States. You can say, well, we grow a lot of food. You're right, we do. But where do we get the stuff to grow? Where do we get the inputs to grow all the food? That would not be in the United States. So we could have all the farmland on the planet Earth. But if you don't have the fertilizer for that farmland, what are you going to do? You say, oh, well, we get it from Canada. Okay, great. Well, let's just say that 40% of that goes offline. What's going to happen to the price of the potash, that you're getting from Canada? It's going to skyrocket because it's a global commodity. So it's going to go to the highest bidder. So if you know, you've got Germany, you've got Japan, you've got China, you've got all these other countries bidding up the price, that means the farmers in the United States are going to have to pay a higher price, higher input cost. So what's going to happen to your grocery bill? What's going to happen the next time you go to Chipotle? You see, so we can grow all the food we want here, but again, those inputs, it's just like the U.S. having the largest military. Oh, okay, that's fine, but where are we getting the inputs for the military? Where are all the commodities coming from that we use to power the military? Not all, but you know, what's going to happen to the price if one of the marginal suppliers is cut out of the mix? And there's a lot of other commodities, just not just energy, that go into military goods. Or where are we getting the supply? I mean, where are we getting the stuff that's the military uses? A lot of it's from China. And so it's the exact same thing, that we may have the end product here, but you've got to ask yourself, you know, where are those inputs coming from? So another thing that he mentioned just very briefly, and I know that Grohman has talked about, I think it's very interesting, is them, Zoltan talks about them settling in gold. So them selling commodities, oil, fertilizer, lumber, coal, uranium, for gold. But I think you might want to take it one step further and say, okay, well, maybe they peg oil to gold, because you got to think about it. Okay, here's actually a pretty simple example. Let's just say that all of your expenses are in dollars because you live in the United States. Makes sense, right? So you would want the majority of your assets or the majority of your cash flow denominated in dollars, because you want your assets to kind of match up with your liabilities in that way. If you had all of your liabilities denominated in dollars, and then all of your income, let's say, or your assets coming in Colombian pesos, well, what happens to you if the Colombian peso depreciates in value? Now you got big problems. So you would want the majority of those assets or cash flow streams coming in dollars. So again, liabilities match up with assets. Well, it's no different with the governments. You know, they're going to want the same thing. And so what is China's liability, as an example, moving forward in the future? Let's just say an unfunded liability. Well, that would be energy, because they're short on the stuff. But they need that stuff to produce the stuff that they export to countries like the United States. So ideally, they would hold a reserve asset that would match up with that liability. But what is that? Because the dollar can fluctuate in price relative to energy. Okay, but if you pegged gold to oil, now all of a sudden, if you hold gold as the reserve asset, bam, you've done it. You've matched up your assets, gold, with your future liabilities, oil. And so then you know that when you know, however much gold you collect, you know that you're going to be able to buy a specific amount of oil in 10 days or 10 years. It doesn't matter. So I know Zoltan didn't really talk about that. Grohman talked about it briefly. And I think it's a very logical step. The probability might be low, but it makes a lot of sense. So I believe it's something that we should be thinking through. Okay, so going back to Zoltan's points here, he also said that the Russian Central Bank could set the price of the ruble if they're the marginal provider. So this is going back to what Russia has done lately, where they are saying, okay, we'll give you natural gas, but you're going to have to buy it in rubles. So then you say, okay, well, who is the marginal provider of those rubles? Where are they going to get them? You know, you can go buy them on the FX market, but is there enough rubles floating around? I don't know. And are there, I don't know how they would do that. I don't know if there's like a euro dollar system set up for rubles where you could get ruble liquidity from commercial bank. You probably could, but they'd have to be banks inside of Russia potentially. I don't know how that would work. That's an interesting question. But the bottom line is Putin is saying that he wants these, or he is demanding that not only be paid in rubles, but they have to, more importantly, they have to set up an account with Gazprom Bank. And that is obviously under the jurisdiction of the Russian government. And he's doing this to make sure that the West doesn't freeze his assets. Because if he had the account going to Deutsche, or the money going to Deutsche account, okay, fine, he gets paid in rubles, so what? They could still freeze the ruble account, because again, then those rubles are a liability of a commercial bank. And so he's saying, okay, move the bank account over to Gazprom Bank, and then you can send us the euros, we'll switch it to rubles. But then Zoltan's point is, okay, well, where are they getting the rubles? Are these new loans that are being provided by the commercial banking system, or are they coming from the central bank specifically? Are they, I don't know if you get them in the FX market again, is there enough that of the supply of rubles? That I don't know. But if it is coming from the Russian central bank, as far as this ruble liquidity, then he said they could pretty much set their own price. So meaning that they could say, okay, well, the ruble is trading at, let's say, 85 to the dollar. Yeah, that's not going to work. We're going to go ahead and sell you these rubles, but we will sell them to you at 30 per dollar or something like that. Or what are you going to do? Say no. Okay, fine. And you don't get your gas. And then, you know, your economy gets cut in half and you go into a massive depression that would make the Great Depression of the United States in 1930 look like a child's birthday party. So that's one point that he discussed that I thought was fascinating that I didn't talk about with Luke the other day, because, you know, Luke and I talked about something. I've done a couple whiteboard videos on topics that are very similar to this. Then, okay, so that's when he talked about potentially settling in gold. And that's where I made the note that you might even want to peg gold to oil or oil to gold at a specific rate to make sure that the central banks that are involved in this kind of new alliance. And he talks about that later on in the interview. I know Luke was talking about that. I've talked about that. Zoltan was talking about that, where you've got this kind of a new bifurcation in the global economy, where instead of this global, this globalization, you have deglobalization, and all the countries look around and say, okay, who are my friends? And then they just kind of do business with each other. And it's kind of the West versus the and the East, very similar to when most of us were growing up in kind of the Cold War type of environment. But see, in that situation, you got to ask yourself, who has the wealth? I mean, look at it from a standpoint of demographics or population. Look at it from a standpoint of energy. Look at it from a standpoint of producing stuff, other commodities. You look at Brazil, India, Saudi Arabia, China, Russia. It's going to be tough for, based on those metrics, you know, compare them to Europe or the United States, Europe and the United States and Australia and Canada, and maybe call it Mexico, call it North America. Especially, and Zoltan points this out as well, when those countries that will most likely form an alliance, an economic alliance in the West, are pushing an ESG narrative or pushing this ESG movement where they're not going to invest any capital in the supply of energy, that's bad. Okay, have fun with that. I mean, wow. Just think about that for a moment. Just think about if the West cut itself off from the energy commodities and stuff from China, Brazil, India, Saudi Arabia, and Russia. And you may say to yourself, well, George, that's absolute nonsense. That'll never happen. Oh, really? Really? What are they doing right now? What are the core? In fact, all of these sanctions, this is another thing that Zoltan points out, that all of these sanctions had cutouts for energy. But you look at all of these corporations in the West, and they've refused to buy energy from Russia because they're trying to virtue signal. So effectively, the corporations themselves have sanctioned themselves from buying energy from Russia. And who's paying the price for that? Well, that would be the citizens. And so, I mean, you look at the headlines and the German CPI is skyrocketing. It's skyrocketing here in the United States, as you guys know. And it's most likely over the next few years, especially if we continue to cut out the supply of commodities from Russia and other places that we deem are evil or quote-unquote unfriendly. I mean, I was reading articles last night how the mainstream media in the West is now claiming that Saudi Arabia is quote-unquote unfriendly. And I read another article that said that India is now unfriendly. So what happens there if we all of a sudden start to treat the stuff that we get from India or the stuff that we get from Saudi Arabia or, you know, we treat those countries like we're doing with Russia? I don't think that's a stretch, especially when you see how much pain people in the West are willing to absorb just to feel good about themselves and believe that they are, or really lie to themselves that they're quote unquote doing something. I sent out a tweet about that. In fact, it's staggering to me. Most of you on this live stream know that these sanctions are very ineffective. And the people who are hurt most by the sanctions are really the citizens of the West. They're the people in Germany. They're the people in France, the people in Russia. The people in the United States. To a certain degree, the people in Russia. But if you look at the economic systems and who's providing the stuff and who's providing the energy, you see very quickly that it's the countries and the economies of the West that are most likely suffering the most from these sanctions. So it just reminds you of this. On Twitter, I called it, it's kind of a sign of the times, where people are so just insane right now that as long as they feel good, they don't care about the results, even if the results are the exact opposite of the intentions. Meaning, in fact, we saw it today that Biden's talk about increasing the sanctions. Well, think about that. What's the definition of insanity? It's just doing the same thing over and over and over again, expecting different results. So what he's basically saying is, okay, the first round of sanctions didn't work, so we just didn't sanction hard enough. So now we're just going to sanction even harder. Why is he doing that? He knows that that's not going to do anything except hurt the citizens of the West even more. So why do it? Because he knows that that's what the people want. Because it makes them feel good. And they don't want to even do the research. They don't want to know that this really has little to no effect on Russia at all. Definitely Putin doesn't care. You know, it doesn't prevent him from doing whatever he's trying to do, right? So the only thing it does is make you feel good. So you're paying a huge cost, but receiving little to no benefit. But people don't care as long as it makes them feel good. So again, what I'm getting at is that in the future, should we assume that people are so rational that they would not excommunicate India, China, Saudi Arabia for the on the exact same premise, that it would just make them feel good, even if the standard of living was cut in half? I mean, I don't know. Is there a limit on people's insanity right now in a world where it's just nothing but mass formation psychosis? I'll let you be the judge. But I think it's something that's definitely within the realm of possibility. That's for sure. So now let's get back to Zoltan here for a moment. He also talks about how when euro dollars are created, they're really recycled into treasuries. So the example he gave is that XYZ Corp borrows money from, let's say, Deutsche, and they borrow dollars. Well, those are dollars that didn't exist before. Deutsche just created them, and XYZ Corp needs those dollars to buy commodities from Saudi Arabia. Okay, well, then they take those dollars, give them to Saudi Arabia. They take the commodities. Saudi Arabia does what with them, or what did they do with them? Then they would take those dollars that were produced by Deutsche in the euro dollar system, and then they would go to, I think Zoltan used the example of a treasury auction, and or those dollars show up at a treasury auction, I think he said. And all that means is just that Saudi Arabia takes those dollars and they buy treasuries with them. So what does this do? This increases the demand for treasuries, and increased demand, price goes up, interest rates go down. And so what he says, if they're no longer recycling these euro dollars, that means that's just a wonky way of saying they're no longer buying treasuries. Therefore, who's going to buy those treasuries? And he also brings up a great point of quantitative tightening, where he said that everyone is really fixated on the Fed doing quantitative tightening, but no one's thinking about other central banks doing quantitative tightening, meaning that all of these other central banks hold treasuries. So what happens when they start to sell the treasuries? Not just their own domestic sovereign debt, but U.S. debt. Okay, well, if you've got more people selling or fewer central banks buying, then essentially this has the same effect as quantitative tightening that the Fed is doing. And that means more supply, less demand. What happens to the price? Goes down, interest rate up. So this was a very interesting observation that, you know, we think through quantitative tightening as something that's domestic, and actually it can be, but it also can be international. And he believes that this is going to happen because we've moved into this Bretton Woods 3, where they're no longer using dollars to transact, or they're using fewer and fewer dollars. Therefore, they'll have fewer and fewer reasons to buy treasuries. Therefore, more and more and more international quantitative tightening. Oh, another thing that he pointed out is, using some esoteric language, is POMOs and TOMOs. And one of the interviewers asked him about the standing repo facility at the Fed and how he thought that may play into this story longer term. And he said, yeah, it's whether they're using the POMOs or the TOMOs, he said the Fed would probably like to use TOMOs just because for kind of optics. But he said they'll use either or just to provide basically the liquidity to soak up all those additional treasuries that are being supplied by the United States government that aren't being soaked up by these foreign entities recycling those euro dollars. So what a POMO, this is just an abbreviation. The POMO would be permanent open market operations, i.e. permanent QE. And then TOMOs would be temporary open market operations. So that would be, So the POMO would be the reverse repo account that we talk about all the time. And then that would be the standing repo facility. And then the temporary, which is really permanent, is quantitative easing. So with the standing repo facility, what is that? Okay, so that's the Fed saying we'll backstop the repo market. So if, let's say, this pans out to where they don't recycle these treasuries, the interest rates go up, that would bring up the repo rates. So the dollar funding prices go up as well. And if that's too much for the domestic economy to handle, or the banking system, the financial system, if it's starting to crack, then the Fed can come in and say, okay, well, if repo spikes to 10%, like it did in September 2019, we'll go ahead and issue repo at 2%, you know, something like that. So we'll backstop the market. And so if you need that dollar liquidity, you can just come to us, and at a non-market interest rate that is, you know, something you can afford. And so if these banks are having to buy the treasuries from Janet Yellen because the foreign buyers just are drying up because of this new monetary system. And if they don't have the liquidity, they can go to repo, they can borrow the dollars from the Fed, they can use those dollars to buy the treasuries, and then they give those treasuries to the Fed. Fed buys them from them, and which is basically just canceling out their debt. So JP Morgan does a repo, basically borrowing $1 billion from the Fed with their standing repo facility. They take the $1 billion, they buy the treasuries from Janet Yellen. Now all of a sudden they've got a $1 billion asset with the treasuries. They got a $1 billion liability with the loan from the Fed. And then they go ahead and sell those treasuries. Then the Fed just wipes out their debt, pays them $1 billion. So it nets out. And then those treasuries go onto the balance sheet of the Fed as an asset. And then what's the liability on the Fed's balance sheet? That would be the $1 billion that went into the TGA, the Treasury General Account, from the purchase of the treasuries in the first place. So I know that was, hopefully most of you were following that, but basically he was just one of the announcers or interviewers brought up Standing Repo, and that's how Zoltan said that it could play into the mix longer term. It's not being used too much right now, but he said that doesn't mean that in the future, you know, 5 years, 10 years down the road, it won't be used to a great degree, especially if we see interest rates really spiking at the long end of the curve because of lack of demand from a lack of these euro dollars that are being recycled or were being recycled in treasuries because fewer and fewer commodities are being settled in dollars. Another thing that he pointed out, very interesting, is, and I think we just discussed this, but companies really sanctioned themselves from food and energy, and they're doing it because the people are demanding it. The people, they want to express their emotional outrage, their hysteria. I mean, that's exactly what we're saying. It makes no sense. It doesn't really stop Putin from doing anything. But it just makes people feel good that McDonald's is no longer in Russia or something. And so, but they're doing that not just with McDonald's and Starbucks, but companies like Shell, as an example, are no longer buying energy from Russia. They've divested their interest in, I think, Gazprom it was, or maybe Lukoil. And what happens? The people pay much higher prices. Nothing really happens to Russia. Putin isn't deterred. And then what happens is all that energy that would have gone to the West to bring down prices and increase supply now goes to China. And so good job. Good job, virtue signalers. And then China goes over to BP and says, hey, you know that that interest you had, that 15% interest or whatever it was in Lukoil, we'll go ahead and buy that from you. But at 10 cents on the dollar. And they're like, oh yeah. It's here. Buy it from us. We'll sell it to you, no problem, because we're woke and we want a virtue signal. And we know that you know, all the politicians in the West and the World Economic Forum and the UN and the EU and, you know, Biden and Trudeau and all these people, you know, they want us to make it look like we're quote unquote doing something. So all the people in the West feel good. And if you know, we have to sell you our Russian assets at 10 cents on the dollar, then that's what we're going to do because we don't want to be, we don't want to have a target on our back. We don't want to have to absorb the wrath of these politicians that could make life very difficult for us if we don't virtue signal to their constituents. I mean, that's really the game that's being played right now. And what's staggering is who's benefiting from this? I mean, we are basically, and I tweeted this out as well, that the people that are on this live stream right now, the people who actually see reality and that are sane, we are paying a tax. We are paying a Russia outrage tax, just like we have paid a COVID hysteria tax since 2020. The fact is, and you guys know this well, that our economy is far less stable today than it was in 2019. And it wasn't even that stable back then. But it's far, far worse. I mean, think about all the inflation. Just ask yourself this question. If the government would not have responded to the Cerveza sickness the way they did, if they would not have done these sanctions and whatnot, do you think that you would be paying as much at the grocery store? Now, inflation may have caught a bid, if you will, or inflation could have had some tailwind for sure. But do you think prices would be as high? Absolutely not. So again, those high prices that you're paying, that's a tax for COVID hysteria. The high prices you're paying now, let's say it's gone up, your monthly expenses have gone up, let's say 20 or 30% since the invasion of Ukraine. That's in part, I'm sure, you know, you got to put some blame on Putin there for sure. But you've also got to put a lot of the blame on the politicians that are just responding to this mob mentality that is just demanding that they do something. And again, paying a tax for their irrationality and paying a tax for their emotional outrage and just this desire to feel good at any cost, regardless of how little benefit there is. And So that's something that Zoltan talked about as well. Let's see here. Take some more protection. Oh, yes. And he says that, and this is another good point that he made, is that because of this mentality, he thinks the world goes into this protectionist mode. And that makes a lot of sense to me. And we discussed this earlier, where the people will just, it doesn't matter how bad the economy gets, they'll still try to push for these policies that make them feel good. And the only thing that makes them feel good is if we cut off all ties with all the bad people, because it's just this overly simplistic worldview of just good versus evil. So China, evil. Russia, evil. Saudi Arabia, India, evil. Therefore, we want to completely cut them off. Okay, well, that means that we go into a Great Depression 2.0. Well, fine. I don't care because I feel good. Okay, fine. That means that you're going to have to wait in line for 4 hours to buy a loaf of bread. Fine. I take that, Putin. Remember, I tweeted yesterday. I don't know if you guys follow me on Twitter, but this gal with the EU said that people just need to take cold showers or whatever it was. And when they're just freezing in the shower, they just need to clench their fist and say, "Take that, Putin." That's the mentality that we're dealing with right now. That's the mass formation psychosis that we're dealing with. So again, is it any stretch to think that those people will take a cold shower or eat less meat or start riding their bicycle to work or accept a standard of living that is equivalent to the Great Depression in the 1930s, just so they can clench their fist and say, "Take that, Saudi Arabia, take that, China, take that, Putin." And, you know, I've been talking about this for quite some time. And so I found it very interesting that Zoltan was really echoing a lot of those thoughts. One other thing he said on that note is with this protectionism and this deglobalization, he said what this does is it takes us from a world where our biggest concern is income inequality to a world where our biggest concern is commodity inequality. I thought that was very powerful because, you know, right now we measure wealth by the amount of currency units. Especially in the United States, we measure wealth by how many dollars we have. But in the future, what he was saying is that's probably not how we're going to measure wealth. We're going to measure wealth the good old fashioned way. And that's commodities, that's energy, that's food. And if you look around the world right now, and if we divide into West and East, who has all, not all, but who is going to have the majority of the low cost food and energy? And so who's going to have the wealth? It's going to be this really kind of this global shift towards the East from the West. As far as standard of living, because, you know, at the end of the day, they have the wealth that really matters. Another thing he brought up is kind of a pushback to what he was saying there with oh, okay, before I get into this, and I think this kind of transitions into what I was going to say, is he talks about how the PBOC, the China Central Bank, can absorb all of the commodities that are persona non grata right now with Russia. So he said that I think the way he phrased it, is the central bank that's going to win here at the end of the day is the one that's going to be able to figure out how to collect all the commodities that the world is not using from China or from Russia and redistribute those, kind of clean them up. It's like money laundering. Clean it up and then sell it back to the United States at a much higher price. So the way he envisioned this happening is the PBOC, let's say, buys all the oil from Russia, they stockpile it for themselves, and that whatever they have left over, they go ahead and sell to let's say, anyone for that, for Japan, let's say, and then Japan sells them to the United States, or maybe they sell them directly to the US, or maybe directly to Japan, or you know, Australia or New Zealand, something like that. And then, so now all of a sudden, they're not getting that dirty, filthy Russian oil that's going to support Putin and his insanity or his megalomania. No. We're getting the oil from one of the good guys. Of course, we're paying double the price. But what they don't know is that's oil that was pulled out of the ground in Russia or a commodity that was pulled out of the ground in Russia. And it just, it kind of, that money laundering, if you will, goes through the Chinese central bank. But also what's important is China is, has the ability to keep all of those commodities and stockpile all of those commodities for themselves in the future. And remember, at you know, next 5 years, 10 years, the wealthy economies are going to be the ones that not have currency, that aren't measured by currency units, but the wealthy economies will be measured, and the standard of living will be correlated with the stuff, with the commodities they have access to, or already have in storage, or already have in the ground, or are willing to extract. Let's not forget about that. Because it's not that, like in the United States, it's not that we don't have the commodities, we're just not willing to extract them. And is the United States going to do a full 180 and go from this woke ESG, you know, virtue signaling, cancel culture, censorship type thing, and you know, with the emphasis on climate change and reducing consumption and eating bugs and eating less meat and riding bicycles, and yada, are we going to do a full 180 from that and say, okay, well, oh, that didn't work, let's just go ahead and go back to the drill, baby, drill? Probably not. Are they going to do that in Europe with this stranglehold that the World Economic Forum has on the minds and the mentality of most of the, or a lot of the people over there? Probably not. So again, you've got the West that, even if they do have the resources, they're not willing to utilize them. And does that bring the standard of living down? Absolutely. So then he goes on to talk about how the one of the pushbacks he gets is that the Chinese have a, so let's just envision this world where the Chinese have all of those resources that they've absorbed from Russia, and that they're distributing them. The pushback he gets is, well, that would never happen because people won't do that type of business with China because they have closed capital accounts. So basically, this is China saying, okay, corporation XYZ, you can have an account here in China, but we're going to micromanage how you can send money in and out of the country. I think there may be some more to it other than that, but that's pretty much kind of the gist of it. And so they don't have complete control over their money, these corporations in China, these closed accounts, closed capital accounts. But the point that Zoltan makes is, okay, well, sure, a month ago, you could have said that that's not applicable to the United States at all. But now, what's the difference between the United States and China? The United States has closed capital accounts. Just ask the Russian Central Bank. And I would argue that on a personal level, and if they're willing to do it to citizens, obviously they'd be willing to do it to corporations. Look at what happened in Canada. As of 2 months ago, Canada had open accounts where you could access your money and transfer it wherever you want. And what happened there? Ask a trucker. You guys know what I'm saying. The accounts are frozen. So all of a sudden, you go from a country having all quote-unquote open accounts where you can do whatever you want to all of a sudden, you're just like China. If they don't like you, or if they don't like what you're saying, or if they don't like your opinion, if you have a dissenting view, then all of a sudden you don't have an open account anymore, do you? So he emphasized this point to really show that, hey, the world changed a month ago. when the United States and the West sanctioned not only Russia, but froze their FX accounts, everything changed moving forward. And it's not that, you know, the dollar is going to lose reserve status. We're going to go into a Bretton Woods 3 overnight. But the cat's out of the bag. Or, you know, whatever phrase, whatever term, whatever saying you want to insert there. Bottom line is we're at the point of no return. Okay, one of the final points that he made is this is a type of crisis that the central banks cannot control. He went back and referenced the GFC as an example, and he said that when you had this type of crisis, it was a liquidity issue, and it was just simply an issue of bad assets. So the Fed could come in and buy the mortgage-backed securities, take them off the bank's balance sheet, do a little bit of QE, and you recapitalize the bank. Done. Problem solved. Or in the case of 2020, the Fed comes in, drops rates to zero, does $120 billion of QE per month, QE infinity. They go in and buy some junk debt, backstop the market. The government comes out and says, we're going to do stimmy checks galore, and problem solved. We paper over the problem. That's fine if you've got an aggregate demand problem. That's fine if you've got a liquidity problem. But if you've got a supply side problem with commodities, that is not fine. That doesn't work. The Fed nor the government can solve that problem. And so the next crisis, he said, or maybe the crisis we could be living through right now, he thought is a crisis of commodities. And it is a crisis that the central planners cannot control. And he didn't say this, but I would insert that they can only make worse, or they will only make worse, especially when you see the insane proposals that have been put on the table by the politicians, such as, oh, well, prices are going up. Easy solution. We'll just give people more money. as though the problem of inflation is caused by a lack of money. No, it's a lack of stuff. And the Fed can't print stuff. The Fed can't print coal. The Fed can't print energy. And let's just say they go green. Okay, well, fantastic. The EU's going green. Remember they said we're going to wean ourselves off of this evil Russian energy. And we've got to do that for the Great Reset agenda and for climate change anyway. Great. What are you going to do? Well, most likely you're going to go to nuclear. Fantastic. Where are you going to get the uranium from that? Ah, that's right. It's processed in Russia. So, you know, any direction you go, still the leverage is with those countries that, if you want to call it the East or whatever, you know, the Chinas, the Russia, the Brazil, the Saudi Arabia, India. I mean, I don't like saying it. I'm an American citizen. I mean, I wish I could sit here and say that the United States is in a power position. But unfortunately, I'd be lying to you. And like I said on Twitter, you've got to play the hand you're dealt. You can't play the hand that you wish you were dealt. And unfortunately, we have shot ourselves in the foot. We have this self-inflicted wound where, as a result of our own ignorance, we have dealt ourselves a bad hand by pursuing these ESG policies. And oh, we wake up one day and oh shoot, we're not creating our own energy. We're not creating our own sources of food and because we're trying to, you know, pander to these constituents and to these Malthusians. And we wake up one day and all of a sudden the taps are turned off. And whose fault is that? You know, now we've got a bad hand. Well, it's a bad hand as a result of decisions that we have made, quite frankly, in the past. And that is a tax that all the sane people on the live stream right now are unfortunately going to have to pay. Moving forward, the last kind of point that he made was on the amount of leverage that the East, or at least these commodity producing countries, will have in the future because of the stated game plan of these Western governments. Number one, and what isn't getting a lot of press in the United States, but I've been reading about it, is the desire for the EU to set up their own military. And Macron was talking about this quite extensively recently. And he wants to kind of divest himself from the U.S. military. They want to set up their own system. They also want to set up, this ESG movement. They want to set up wind and solar. Well, creating these windmills, as Zoltan points out, where are you going to get the steel for that? Where are you going to get the diesel fuel to transport them? You know, where are you going to get all these things? Where are you going to get all the commodities, the metals that go into creating weapons or arms for the military? Any direction you go, where are you going to get the money for where are you going to get these things that go into an electrification of the economy? Things like copper, things like neon, and I'm sure you guys know nickel is another huge one. Where are you going to get this stuff? Well, it's got to be from the commodity producers. And if you're not willing to drill, or if you're not willing to access any of those resources domestically because you're too holy and you care too much about the environment, well, fine. You're going to have to get it from the East that's willing to do that. And that's going to make you even more beholden to them. And it's going to give them more leverage. And that means they have more wealth. And that was one of the points that Zoltan made. Lastly, what he talked about is the inversion of the curve. The interviewers asked him his opinion, and he thought it was kind of a non-issue. And the reason he thought it would not lead to a recession was he thought that as soon as there's a whiff of recession, the governments will come in and basically do CARES Act 2.0. Stimmies, gas checks, food checks. We should call them food stamps, I guess. He thinks that this is what they'll do. In fact, he thinks they'll maybe even do this prior to a recession, which will prevent the recession from happening that the yield curve is predicting. And the bond market, he just doesn't think has figured that out. And then he says he thinks very soon the yield curve will not be inverted because the long end will go up as a result of people figuring out that we have moved into this Bretton Woods 3 type global monetary system, where those euro dollars, or any dollars for that matter, aren't going to be recycled into treasuries. So that was kind of how they concluded the interview. All right. Well, you know what? I was going to go into Rebel Capitalist Pro. Let's see if I know I've been going almost an hour here, but we got a lot of people still on. So let me dive into that, because that could give you guys some further insights that I might not have addressed with my notes. And this is a subscriber in Rebel Capitalist Pro. I won't give their name, but they brought up some incredible points after listening to this podcast that they wanted to get my opinion on. So number one was the inversion of the curve. We talked about that. And Al Zoltan thought that was wrong and the market was just offsides. The savings glut by non-G7 countries is over. So we talked about this, and the way Zoltan references it. This is kind of the QT example I gave, that the Fed's doing QT. That's what we're focused on. But he's thinking about the international QT from a standpoint of these of the international central banks. And the way he says it is, there are these warehouses of treasuries that they're going to puke up a lot of duration. And again, you gotta, Zoltan seems like you just can't comprehend what he's saying, but he's not saying anything that's that hard to follow. It's just hard to follow because of the words and the he just uses all these industry terms and industry lingo. And this is a good example of that, where here's a quote from him. He says, duration is duration, and it's warehoused in many different places for many different reasons, but those warehouses are about to puke up a lot of duration. That's, again, that's just a very esoteric way of saying that all these central banks have treasuries that they're going to sell or not buy in the future. And so that was really the point there, that is in essence doing QT while the Fed is doing QT, which will most likely or give a lot of headwind to treasury prices and therefore tailwind to treasury yields or interest rates at the end, long end of the curve. The world is entering a new interest rate regime. Okay, so this is when Zoltan was talking about, and he didn't reference this specifically, but basically, I think he's saying that, you know, we've been in a 40-year bond bull market, and now we are going to go into a 30, 40-year bond bear market where interest rates will continue to go up. Not going to go up in a straight line, but if you remember, the one of the last bond bear markets, or I guess the last bond bear market, started in 1951, I want to say, probably where they ended the explicit curve or yield curve control. And so probably you're talking, you know, 1955, something like that. And so that was really the start of the bond bear market that ended, as you guys know, in 1981. And so it doesn't happen all at once, but he believes that we're kind of, this is our 1955 moment, or maybe 2020 was our 1955 moment, and interest rates are going up from here, but again, doesn't happen quickly, and they don't go up in a linear fashion. Fed will hike interest rates, but not enough to bring... So he's basically saying, this is kind of the Peter Schiff idea, that in order to bring inflation back down to, let's say, 1% or under the 2% target rate, they would have to take real rates positive. And in order to do that, right now, real rates would have to be above 7.9% Fed funds, and that ain't going to happen. And so basically, Zoltan is just reiterating kind of that idea that we've been hearing from Schiff for quite some time. I'm kind of on the fence on that one, because I see this playing out. This could play out the 2020s, very similar to the way the 1940s played out. In the 1940s, like after we had that spike up to 19% in CPI, it actually went negative inflation, so therefore deflation. I don't think we get to that point. But I think you might see these spikes up to 10, 12% and then back down to like 6, 5, something like that, and then back up. I'm definitely in the camp that they can't take rates high enough to be positive in real terms. I totally agree with that. But I do think there's a possibility that they get rates up to a point where they break the market, and that reduces the high levels of inflation that we've been currently seeing. Again, not down to 2%, even 3%, but you know, from 7.9 goes up to 8.59, and then maybe back down to 6, down to 5.5 before the government comes in and does more deficit spending and then takes it off, and you're on the next cycle up higher. Then he talks about one of my whiteboard videos with repo, and I'm sure you guys have seen that. So that's kind of the details of what this person wanted to ask me in Rebel Capitalist Pro. So just as a reminder, guys, you can see the pros that we have doing live streams this month or every month. We've got Lynn Alden, Chris McIntosh, me 4 times a month, Jason Hartman, Brent Johnson, Patrick Serezna, and Tony Greer, where you as members can come in and just ask us any question you want, just like that one. And we come on live and answer those questions for you. And it also includes the premium newsletters and research from Lynn Alden and Chris McIntosh, along with this awesome forum where you can talk to your fellow rebel capitalists. So I just wanted to give a quick pitch there for that. You can check it out at georgegammon.com/pro. You can do a trial, like a 1-week trial for $1. So So definitely check that out. All right, guys, that was kind of my summary of what Zoltan was talking about with Bretton Woods 3. I think if you go watch the video, you're going to have a much better understanding as to what he's saying. And even if you don't watch the video, I think I kind of I gave you the main talking points, and hopefully in a way that's easy to understand. And I'll actually be doing a whiteboard video on it tomorrow. So look for that on the George Gammon channel tomorrow night. All right, guys, as always, make sure that you're standing up for freedom, liberty, free market capitalism, and we'll see you in the next video.